Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of the All 80s Movies Podcast, the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. I'm your host, Bill Bant, and along with me on this journey back to the 80s is my co-host, Jason Masek. Hello, Jason.
Hey, Bill. Get your damn hands off her. Do you really think I ought to swear?
Yes, goddammit, Jason, swear. That's right, listeners. Today we will be discussing the 1985 blockbuster Back to the Future, starring Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, and Leah Thompson. Directed by Robert Zemeckis, this movie is rated PG with a running time of 1 hour and 56 minutes. It won an Oscar for Best Effects, Sound Effects Editing. It was also nominated for Best Writing, Screenplay Written Directly for the Screen, Best Sound, and Best Music Original Song, which was The Power of Love, performed by Huey Lewis and the News. So, what is this movie about? What's on the box? If you grew up in the 1980s and went to your local video store to rent this movie, you would find this description on the back of the VHS box. It is What's on the Box. Take it away, Jason.
One of the top grossing box office comedies of all time. Steven Spielberg presents an irresistible comic fantasy that accelerates beyond the time barrier with wit, imagination, and infectious wide-eyed wonder. Michael J. Fox stars as Marty McFly, a typical American teenager of the 80s, accidentally sent back to 1955 in a plutonium-powered DeLorean time machine invented by slightly mad scientist Christopher Lloyd. During his often hysterical, always amazing trip back in time, Marty must make certain his teenage parents-to-be, Crispin Glover and Leah Thompson, meet and fall in love so he can get back to the future. Directed by Robert Zemeckis, this delightful comedy adventure will make everyone want to get back to the future over and over again.
I'm always surprised how much they can get on the back of those boxes.
Oh, hell yes. Bill, you don't need money. Don't take fame. Don't need no credit card to ride this train. It's strong and it's sudden and it's cruel sometimes, but it might just save your life. That's the power of love.
Oh, it is the power of love.
Bill Bant, welcome to Season 2.
Season 2, yes. Kicking it off.
We are starting off with a banger, Back to the Future.
Doesn't get any bigger.
This is what it's all about, my friend.
Yep, so that was What's on the Box. So as always, let's move on to our earliest memories. What are our earliest memories of Back to the Future? Jason, start us off.
Those three notes... That's it for me right there. I know. That's definitely one of my earliest memories. I mean, it's really about that theme for me. I hear those three notes and I just get chills.
One of my all-time favorite themes. Yes.
It is. So thank you, Alan Silvestri. I definitely saw this movie in the theater with my family. I recall how funny it was. I remember as a kid just really laughing a lot in this. And obviously, it's a sci-fi comedy, no question about it. But I think as a kid, I was just really pleasantly surprised because going in, I knew I would be enthralled by the science fiction aspect of it, the adventure aspect of it, the time travel aspect of it. But I don't think I was prepared for how funny it was. So it was really adventurous and clever. And I recall that... Or at least I think I most likely had an innate sense of how smart the storytelling was. So walking out of the theater after seeing this for the first time, just being in awe as how well-rounded and well-told the story was, just how complete this movie was and still is to this very day. Next up, the DeLorean. Hell yeah. Hell yeah, I still love this car. You know what? I'm going to share this right now with you, Bill Bant. I had a neighbor around the corner from me in Lindenhurst, Illinois, that owned one.
No way.
Yep. At this time. It was so cool. And it was a neighbor I did not know. I knew a lot of neighbors on my street. It was back then, especially in this small town. Neighbors knew one another, but this neighbor happened to be just around the corner and far away enough that I did not know them. However, I'm riding my bike around the neighborhood, and every time I passed the driveway and it kind of sloped downward and I knew it was parked down there, I would try to catch a glimpse, but I didn't want to be too much of a creeper and just hang out and stare at it and gawk at it from a distance. So it was always kind of in passing. But if I was in a car or, riding my bike by, I mean, I was always looking for it. And then I'd catch it every once in a while on the road. And I just thought it was so cool. And so I was always surprised at how low to the ground it was. Now, obviously, today we have a lot of modern sports cars and luxury vehicles that are extremely low to the ground and very flat, right? But this was, to me, in my memory, one of the first of its kind. So, and of course, the signature gull wing doors, also known as butterfly doors, the way they open up to the side versus like scissor doors that you'll see on a Lamborghini, which are cool too. But I kind of am always now partial to the gull wing doors or butterfly doors. So the DeLorean as a time machine, of course, early memory. And that's what turned me. I've always been infatuated and fascinated by that car ever since. Speaking of music, I spoke of the orchestral film score by Alan Silvestri, but you mentioned it right off the bat, Huey Lewis in the News. I mean, we have the power of love, Back in Time. I love Huey Lewis. So I definitely associate Huey and the News with the 80s. So he's part of the Back to the Future experience. You can't separate the two. I remember having the soundtrack on cassette, most definitely, and listened to that baby over and over again. You know, I remember, you know, this movie being a sci-fi comedy, but it was also a romance. You know, it was a love story too, about getting the parents back together. But also, one of my early memories was the takeaway of the Doc and Marty relationship. Doc Brown and Marty McFly's relationship hit home for me as a kid. I really felt it when Doc gets, spoiler alert, pause the podcast for 10 seconds, when Doc gets shot in the beginning. And then regarding the letter at the end of the film, that stuff hit home with me. Like it tugged at my heartstrings as a kid. I recall that. Leah Thompson, thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Huge crush. Huge crush on her. So that's an early memory. Crispin Glover was absolutely weird and hilarious to me. I was completely fascinated and confounded at the same time by this actor as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
I was always trying to impersonate him, imitate him. My impersonation, by the way, sucks now. I made a lame attempt in the opening quote, but I used to do it as a kid because he was just so weird and his movements and just kind of strange nervousness. And apparently he was a bit like that as a person. And I've seen him and I remember always wanting to see him on talk shows.
Oh yeah. I remember the Letterman.
Yeah. He's a strange dude.
Yep.
Strange dude.
I can kick.
Go ahead. What's that?
You know, cause he does that. I can kick. Right. And the whole Letterman thing. And then they go commercial and he's off the air. And look, you can find that on YouTube. Crispin Glover on Letterman. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Crispin Glover as George McFly. So yes, the actor that plays George McFly in this film. Also, early memory, you know, I've always had some sort of attachment to the 50s. So even as since I was a kid. So the fact that this movie picks that particular decade to go back to time travel back to, was perfect for me. I was like, yeah, absolutely. So much fun. I love everything about the 50s, the music. I mean, Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. The style of the 50s, the neon, the clothes, the cars, the diners, the cruising. It was just cool. So made me think of American Graffiti too, you know, one of Lucas's first there.
Yeah.
And just everything about it was very romantic to me. Some quick other memories. 1.21 gigawatts. I always remember that. Doc Brown, Christopher Lloyd, amazing. He's just so exasperated all the time. And just his facial expressions, the white hair going everywhere. Einstein the dog, the model of the downtown area that Doc Brown builds to rehearse their basically plan to get Marty back to the future. The model car catching fire and then setting fire. And Doc Brown's gasp always made me laugh so hard as a kid. That's an memory from early on. Obviously, the clock tower. Biff as the bully. Like, what a great 80s bully. One of the best of all time. Such yes. I give so much credit to Thomas F. Wilson, excuse me, the actor plays Bill. He nails it. That line, I would say all the time in school when he screws up that punny phrase, make like a tree and get out of here. Yes. I used to say that all the time.
Suppose all that was improv.
Yeah. So yeah, I was always quoting this book, like I said, and doing the impersonations. Yes, goddammit, George Swear, loved it. Doc Brown, as I mentioned, lines like, do you know what this means? It means this damn thing doesn't work at all. I used to, you know what line I used to say as a kid all the time? This is one of my early memories. Oh my God, they found me. I don't know how, but they found me. Like I would say that in case, either any time it was like in a really dramatic situation. Mm-hmm. And people would be like, what are you doing? Like, what are you talking about?
I think I remember using that one in college, to be honest.
I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
If you're just hanging out and then you just look over your friend's shoulder as somebody else is approaching, you're just, oh my God, they found me. I don't know how.
Libyans.
Speaking of which, the Libyan terrorist Volkswagen. I forever as a kid, since after this movie, always identified that van as the terrorist van. Right. Unfairly. I'm sorry, Volkswagen. It's not PC. None of it's right. But I don't say it out loud anymore. But every time I see a Volkswagen van on the road, I still in my head, I'm like, terrorist van.
Libyans.
Yeah. Terrorist van. last early memory I have, definitely Marty in the radiation suit pretending to be Darth Vader. I mean, I'm a Star Wars kid, right? So the Star Wars reference there was huge for me.
And totally geeked out. Yep.
Those are some early memories. How about you, Bill Bant?
So the earliest memory for me was the trailer with the clip of Marty getting blown across the room with the speaker and the guitar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What a great opening. Yeah.
Which I find funny when you think about the movie as a whole, because I find that scene almost to be like ridiculous. Like it's it doesn't fit into the tone of the movie, even though the whole movie is essentially ridiculous because there's time travel. But there's just something about that that's weird. But I just remember as a kid just thinking that was just crazy. I'm like, oh my God, he's playing a guitar and he just got blasted across the room for it. I did see this in the theater. I remember my mom taking me and then the theater being fairly packed. It was out a couple of weeks at that point, but it really was a audience involved movie. Like they were really getting into it.
Sure.
Like the scene where, you know, Doc is trying to put the cable back and he doesn't make it. The whole audience just like, oh.
Oh, yeah.
And then even the end where they go into the future and the movie just cuts. The whole audience is just like, oh, because they just want it more. They were just so into it. They really wanted to see what it was going to be like going into the future. At that point, we had no idea there was going to be a sequel. Just the collective gasp from the audience. It was just great.
Yeah.
I just remember Marty with the skateboard.
Yeah,
so that, sure. Of course, you know, I had to ask my parents for a skateboard. And of course, you know, you had the one friend that tried doing the skateboard along the car, just like he did. Luckily, luckily, successfully, he's still okay.
Good.
But
I thought you were going to say he tried to do the let the skateboard go underneath the car, climb over the car, hop back onto it as it comes out the other side.
No, just tagging onto the truck, which we would always do every time that like a delivery truck came down your street.
Oh, it's a thing.
Yeah. Yep. That started that trend. Like you said, Biff, just one of the best antagonists from the 80s. You just hated him.
Biff Tannen.
You're so happy he got his comeuppance at the end.
Oh, yeah. It's great.
Like you, just the whole 50s aspect of it. I think loving the fact you got all the references, the whole fish out of water story was just great. You know, everybody making fun of Marty because he has the jacket. Because I had one of those too. I think in blue.
I put that in my notes. That really made me laugh so hard on this rewatch. I didn't realize how many jokes, references there were to his life jacket.
Oh, yeah.
In the 50s. It's so funny. It's a running gag and it holds up. It's so funny.
Yeah, because he gets tired of it the one point where he's at Lorraine's house and he's just like Coast Guard. He just says,
that's like, the line I actually wrote because her, when they're coming down the stairs at the Baines household, which is Lorraine, his mother's house.
Right.
The technically it's his grandmother, but it's Lorraine's mom comes down the stairs and goes, she says, so tell me, Marty, how long have you been in port? Yeah. That, I don't know. That line escaped me as a kid. And upon rewatch, I caught it, of course, or paid more attention to it. And that one made me really laugh.
But yeah, it's just a fun movie. Just one of those you go back to every time because you see it on TV and you're just like, I can't shut it off now, no matter where it is. And it goes by so fast. I was watching with my wife and she was like, this is almost over already for a 2-hour movie. That's just a great compliment to the film. It's just so much fun.
Absolutely. Great call, Bill. Definitely don't want to undersell just how influential and impactful this movie is. Smack dab in the middle of the 1980s. You mentioned some like the pop culture influences it had. By the way, were you a skateboarder?
No.
I was terrible. I never got into
it. I was not good at that either. I mean, I got a skateboard after this because of the movie, but it was not the best of skateboards. And no, I was not good at it at all.
Yeah, I kind of related that one story when we did Can't Buy Me Love. The closest I came was being at my buddy Jason Ferris's house. He had a half pipe in his backyard and just watching the guys do their skateboarding thing. And then we walked over to the Antioch Theater and watched Can't Buy Me Love back to back to back, the Dollar mm-hmm. Theater. But I would watch people do it. I was terrible at it. But yeah, it had obviously a little Pepsi product placement. But like you, I loved the touches. And I didn't think it was overdone either when they go back to the 50s with when he first arrives back in Hill Valley and he's downtown and he sees all just how everything is clean and you have all the gas station attendants running out to attend to the car, the music, you know, Mr. Sandman is playing and the style of dress. I mean, the signage. All the little touches and details really, really make it great. And then, of course, when he goes into the diner and encounters his father, George McFly, there's a lot of great things. The costumes are wonderful. But yeah, I have a lot of, you know, not a lot, I should say, I have some initial thoughts, but I just started off by saying, you know, don't want to undersell just how great this particular film is. Because you said it in an hour and 56 minutes, this they accomplished what many revere and respect as a perfect screenplay. This is how you do it. They teach this in film class. There's such a balance of all elements within a really well-crafted three-act structure within this film. Another initial thought I had, Bill Bant, was just, you know what, a great memory of mine, the Back to the Future ride at Universal.
Oh, yeah, I know. I would love just walking through and then all of a sudden hearing the music.
Absolutely. And of course, you, myself, and Marwan in Orlando climbing on the train that they had from Back to the Future to 3.
Yep.
And we decided to jump over the rope and climb onto the train and get an action shot as if we were in the movie. Yeah. Trespassing.
Yeah, I love that ride, unless I was sitting in the back row in one of the corners because I was too tall and I would always slam my head. And yeah,
it's a great ride.
I love that ride. I miss that ride. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another major thought that I had on this rewatch was the moment that Marty and Doc are together in this movie, things really become electric. No pun intended. But the scene that happens at the Twin Pines Mall, which I'll get into later, is just fantastic. It's the first time we see them together on screen. And as I mentioned earlier, that relationship really hit home for me. Their chemistry, Michael J. Fox, who plays Marty McFly, and Christopher Lloyd, who plays Doc Emmett Brown, their chemistry works so well in both the past and present within this story. Their relationship is absolutely integral, and it has to work in order for everything else to work in this movie. And I love those two on screen together. I think they're just fantastic. Just really resonates with me. I had never noticed before how slightly run down Hill Valley is in the present when the movie begins. I
felt the same way. I thought the same thing too.
I always thought this was more of like the kind of a perfect Southern California small town.
Mm-hmm.
You do see the mountains in the background from time to time.
Yeah.
But I just had forgotten how, you know, you can see downtown Hill Valley where in that downtown square, like the movie theater is showing a XXX film that you can see on the marquee. It says Orgy American Style.
Yeah.
I was like, what? This is in Back to the Future. The graffiti on the high school. And then when Marty skateboards into the Lion Estates where his home is, where his family lives, there's graffiti everywhere. I was like, wow, Why? How did that get by me before?
I thought the same exact thing.
So that was initial thought upon this rewatch. And as a kid, for me, it totally worked. Here's kind of an example of then and now, whereas now as an adult, some of the exposition is, because I'm an adult, obviously I've seen this film several times, and I'm always kind of examining the movie as it's happening. I'm like, oh, okay, they're really setting us up for what's to come. Versus as a kid, I'm just watching it going, oh, this is all cool. Like you said, that opening with the guitar is hilarious. All the clocks, when we have the opening credits in the very, very beginning of the movie, are great. There's a little foreshadowing I hadn't noticed before, where you have a guy hanging off one of the hands of the clock.
Yep.
That's for, you know, kind of what happens at the end of the film. So some of that foreshadowing and exposition is great. It's just interesting watching it now as an adult going, oh, this is obviously setting up. We're going to see references or callbacks to all of this later on in the film. But it's still really smart because every piece of dialogue in this setup, I think, is purposeful. Like, it's there for a reason. There's no wasted lines. I always thought Jennifer, played by Claudia Wells, who is Marty's girlfriend, Jennifer, was very cute. And it's unfortunate she had to be recast in the sequels.
Yeah.
Because she was dealing with some personal issues, family issues. Was it her grandmother? Was it her mother that had cancer?
Mm-hmm.
And then she couldn't do the sequels.
Yeah, so she dropped out of acting just to take care of her mom.
Yeah, so tough situation, tough circumstances. But they ended up casting in the sequels. Who did they cast? She was somebody. I think I was a fan of hers. She's an attractive young lady. Oh, yeah, that's right. Elizabeth Shue. So that's a win for all of us, the recasting there. But still, shout out to Claudia Wells, who plays Jennifer, because she's very cute and very good in this movie. I forgot just how Lorraine, the character in this movie, is instantaneously horny in this movie. My goodness. She is, like, I remember that as a kid. I had a crush on her. Obviously, Leah Thompson is a very attractive actress and woman. But, man, she doesn't waste any time. She is all over Marty, a.k.a. Calvin Klein. That just jumped out to me.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, too, because, I mean, we really knew Michael J. Fox from Family Ties. And this was really his first movie that we knew him from. You know, he's actually a pretty good-looking guy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
When you look at what else Lorraine had to choose from there at the school, yeah, he would stand out. I could see why there was an instant attraction, like a cute, handsome.
No doubt.
Yeah, I could definitely see it.
Yeah. Michael J. Fox cleans up good, especially in this role, you know, in the 50s, when they get him into the 50s wardrobe.
And he fits, he's got right
the
in.
Hair slit back a little bit. He looks like a young, like 50s heartthrob.
Mm-hmm.
He totally plays the role. Plays it well. Yeah. Other initial thoughts, I'll rattle through these. The photo of Marty's family being erased as the movie goes on, his brother and his sister, that still creeps me out to this day. Creep me out then as a kid. It still creeps me out to this day. It's just weird when, like, his brother's head is missing all of a sudden in the photo.
Right.
I just think that's super creepy.
I never caught that before, too, when the first time he looked at the photo and you already noticed that the brother's head, like the hair was missing. I don't think I ever really caught that before.
Oh, I don't know if I caught that this time.
Yeah. So the first time he shows the picture of him and his brother and sister, Doc actually says something like, oh, it's a bad, well, not Photoshop, because you know what Photoshop was, but he's like, oh, his head's already chopped off. Oh, wait. Yeah. Okay. Now I got what he was saying.
That's funny. I was kind of looking for it, but I didn't see. That's pretty subtle.
Yeah.
And then finally, one thing I was thinking about while watching this, as an adult now, how does this hold up as a time travel movie? Because we've seen many now, so many different films in so many different decades and different genres have attempted a time travel storyline. And it's not always successful. And does this hold up as a time travel movie? Do I get caught up in the time travel aspect? Am I always looking to figure it out, poke holes or nothing? And you know what? The answer is yes, this still holds up as a great time travel movie for me personally, and that's my opinion. I don't get too consumed with the science of it. It still works for me. I don't find myself getting distracted by it. It still tracks well enough that because I'm so interested in just these characters and the drama and the action and the adventure, that the time travel becomes just one other aspect of this. It just happens to be the circumstances that these characters are in or under. And it works for me. I don't know how you feel about that.
I mean, time travel movies in itself, there's always so many things you can poke holes through and but it's not bothersome. Like, you know, okay, so we know that when Marty, you know, changes the course of how George and Lorraine meet, everything really changes from that point on. So technically, Marty could still not exist because maybe they don't have three kids. I thought it would have been funnier if when he came back, like, his brother and sister were completely different, like recast as two different people, because technically they had two different kids now. You're not going to have the same kids, or he's not going to live in the same house because the course has all changed.
Sure. Even the subtlest little thing would change. Yeah.
Right.
Cross. Yeah.
But because the movie's so fun, you don't really think about that stuff. You're just kind of happy how it turns out. Like, yes, their lives are better. But yeah, you could poke holes in every time travel route because everything's just going to change. So it's never going to be perfect. But the way that the story unfolds, it just works. It just works.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the films that try to, there's certain films that the more they try to explain the time travel aspect, the less believable it becomes.
Right, because that was always the big complaint about Back to the Future 2, that it didn't make sense to people. Mm-hmm. But in a way that's almost truer is the fact that with Biff going back, he literally changes everything. Everything changes, and that would make more sense of what would happen if you were to go back in time and change events like that, something significant enough. I still like it. But yeah, any time travel movie, you can poke holes through it through and through because we don't understand.
Right.
We're not time traveling, so we don't really know.
One of my favorite things, this was brought up in another podcast recently, and I thought it was funny because I'm a fan of the Rian Johnson film Looper. There's a great moment when Bruce Willis sits down at a diner table across from Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's supposed to be the younger version of himself. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt is about to ask him all these questions because he's looking at himself across the table. And Bruce Willis basically says, no, don't even ask me about time travel. It's just going to melt your brain, or some form of that. Like, I'm paraphrasing, which is just great. Like, I love that they did that because it's like, we don't need to get bogged down in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're telling a story here, and the time travel is just, it's the science fiction aspect or a small aspect of this entire story. We're more about, you know, we want to know more about the relationships and how they're going to unfold in this story.
Like, another thing that drives me up the wall, and it's unmoving, is sports related. When people are watching a sporting event and maybe something happens in the third quarter, like a receiver dropped a surefire touchdown pass and they lose the game, and everyone's like, well, if he had caught that pass, they would have won the game. No, we don't know that because everything changes from that point on through the rest of the game. Who knows if the other team doesn't go down now and score two touchdowns, or you end up fumbling the ball on your next series. Everything changes from that point on. You cannot say, like, when fans get upset about that, like, you cannot say that because now it has changed the course of history from that point on in the game. I mean, it's fun to point at it and say it happened, like, feel, unless it's the last play of the game.
Yeah.
Anything can change from that point on.
I, you know, and that's the kind of thing, if you think about it too long, it will melt your brain.
It does.
And it makes me think of the butterfly effect. It makes me think of sliding doors. It's like, if you made that one decision, it would just have this ripple effect that would have given you a completely different life if you had made a different decision in a particular moment, you know, but it can go a zillion different ways. Again, speaking of another time travel movie, in recent times, we have Endgame, which has the time heist, and you have Doctor Strange, who literally is looking at 14 million different scenarios, and there's only one in which our heroes, the Avengers, can win, or whatever it is. You know what I mean? that stuff, if you try to really understand it, will match. Right. So the bottom line is exactly what you said, Bill Bam. Back to the Future is great fun, and the fun prevails over.
Right. You don't get to the ending and be like,
down in time travel stuff.
Ah, oh, why did it end like this? No, it's fun how it ended like that. It's great because there's even that scene where Marty explains like, oh, it's great. He knocked Biff out, and Doc just has that pause. Like it's all processing. Like, oh my God, how is this going to change?
Oh, that's good. But oh no, this. Okay. Never mind.
Yeah. Right. Cause even him, he could be thinking like, is Marty going to exist when this is all said and done? Who knows?
It's a subtle moment that I picked up on this time around. It's a great call. That moment that Doc has, that's towards the end. And we talk about suspension of disbelief often on this podcast, because that's a big part of 80s movies, this wide-eyed wonderment watching these movies, especially with effects like this particular film where you just, I have never seen anything like this before. And this is a different take on time travel within a different story. And this is cool. And you just want to go along for the ride.
Yeah, that's the thing, because the movie is just so fun. You're just, take me where you're going to take me to next.
I think what I was, what I was going to say before, it makes enough sense for me to buy it, to uphold that suspension of disbelief. I'm like, yeah, I go with it. Sure.
Because you just so get wrapped up in the nostalgia. And we haven't even talked about this, just the fact that you can go back in time and meet your parents. I'm sure this has crossed everyone's mind. Like, you never think of your parents as teenagers or kids. You know, growing up, you would see pictures of them and it would just be weird to see your parents younger. But the fact that you would never get to interact with your parents, would I be friends with my dad if we were the same age, if I went back in time? Or what would I learn about my mom going back? That kind of thing. That's fascinating. Fascinating.
I'm going to jump ahead to the trivia or behind the scenes, because that is the great thing, is that is exactly what Bob Gale did. Wasn't he looking through a yearbook and looking at it was his father's yearbook and just saying, what would it have been like to go back, and would I be friends with my dad if I went back in time and attended high school with my dad?
Yeah.
Would we be friends? And it's just what you were saying. It makes me think of, you usually ask your parents, how did you meet?
Yes.
And I've heard how my parents had met several times. Mm-hmm. And you get different versions.
Yeah.
And they tell, and you get different details in each version and different perspectives. And it's fun. It's great. And sometimes the story changes over the years, or you get more details and you're trying to put it all together. But to go back in time, then to see how it actually happened. And I think that's the real interesting thing about this movie. You're not focused on the time travel itself. It's more of how interesting it would be if you could time travel. Not how do you time travel. It's what would you see or do if you could time travel.
Right. Because even when you listen to those stories of how your parents met or what they did, you still kind of picture parents in the present. You don't think of them as teenagers or in their early 20s or know, when they met or something like that, because you never really saw them like that. You know, I try to go back to the earliest memory I could think of my parents.
Sure.
But it still doesn't fit that way. But yeah, the fact that you could actually be there.
The closest I've come is seeing old, like 8mm films of my parents before I was born. And it's wonderful to see them so full of life and running around and goofing off and flirting with one another, et cetera, with other family members. And they look so young and they're beautiful. And it's, you know, all of that. It's very romantic. So they do a great job in this movie, Back to the Future, of kind of showing a little bit of all that and getting you more interested in that. Because literally in the present day, when this movie opens and we see Marty McFly's life and his girlfriend, Jennifer, and then he goes home and we see how Biff is this, he's a big bully, and we see his parents, and they're kind of like a middle class family in this kind of rundown neighborhood, or sort of rundown neighborhood. And his mom Lorraine starts talking about how she doesn't approve of Marty's girlfriend, but also how back in her day she didn't like to park and she wouldn't do anything, you know, all these bad things. And then of course when he goes back in time and sees the younger version of her, she actually did do all of those things like that.
Yeah.
So that's exactly like what we're talking about. It's like, were our parents different people when they were younger? And what would they be like? And what would it be like to talk to them or try to associate with them?
Yeah, just the little things, like what kind of music they listen to, or just what did they do when they, you know, got out of school? It's the small detail. Like, you know, you ask your parents and they give you general stuff, but there's like the details that you'll never get. Like, you'll never know about them, which is just great, because then you can kind of see this in the movie. And that's what I like about it.
You could get into a whole philosophical question about how we view our parents as we get older, because as the years go by, we see our parents as humans too. Like, they become more human to us, instead of just these either role models as we hope they would be, or we look up to them, or they're the rule makers. And sometimes we want to be them, or we look up to them for different reasons. So that's another aspect. Like, if you go back in time, you're almost like, I would like to see them as kids, to see them just be them, just be freewheeling kids. They were kids too once, just like us. Anyway, good stuff. You can really, really go down a rabbit hole with that. Did you have any other initial thoughts?
I'll just be really quick, because, you know, I've seen this movie so many times, and it's one of those, like, what could I find that I've never noticed before? I found it interesting watching this for the first time, because I really didn't remember that much about the beginning, like the whole Rube Goldberg with the clocks and the can, the Einstein, you know, the food. And I found that kind of interesting, because you would think, because it's such a huge film, you're just thinking like this huge production, the soundtrack's going to be blaring right away. And it's very simple. You look at the budget, it didn't really cost a lot of money to make this movie. So you have to do all the tricks of the trade that you can to try to make sure you get this movie done. I almost was surprised by the simplicity in the beginning.
It's great. So I agree. Kind of that stood out to me too.
And then the second thing that I can't believe I never caught this before, was when Doc is on the street and he's doing the experiment and the cop comes up to him and he asks him if he has a permit.
I love that moment. Yeah.
I never realized he was bribing the cop. I always thought he had gotten a permit and he was pulling out of his wallet. You know, as a kid, I didn't get that. But now I'm like, oh, he's bribing him. He's bribing him so the cop will go away.
I never put that together. I'm an idiot. You just made me. I always thought he was just kind of stalling, because he literally opens his wallet and he's saying, must be in here somewhere. But that totally makes sense. We don't actually see him.
No, we don't see him pull the money out. But then that's the first time I was totally like, I think he's bribing him.
Yeah, he's bribing him.
But yeah, but like I said, I've seen this movie like almost 30 times. I never caught that before. So I thought that was cool. But that's what I love, going back, Bill. Yeah. And doing it for the podcast, because then I'm really looking for stuff like this that I just let it go before. So I thought that was kind of fun. Like, oh, Doc's bribing the cop. That's awesome.
It's smart too, because what you're paying attention to in that moment is in the foreground. It's Marty putting the letter in Doc's coat pocket.
Right. Yeah.
That's what you're focusing on. You don't notice what Doc is doing in the background.
Yeah.
Great stuff, man. This movie is so awesome.
Oh yeah.
Guys, ladies and gentlemen, listeners, we just hope you're big fans of this movie as we are. It's another game changer. This is just, it's awesome to talk about.
All right. So let's move on to favorite scenes or moments. I'm sure we have plenty of those, but we'll
try to streamline it as much as possible.
There we go. So, okay. So what are our favorite scenes or moments of Back to the Future?
Why don't you start us off, Bill Bant?
Okay. So of course, for me, the first one's got to just be the explanation of time travel. Doc has discovered time travel and he's showing it to Marty. And this got me fascinated too, because I really want to know more about how Marty and Doc became friends. It's such an unlikely friendship. And here it is Marty literally goes to Doc's house, knows the key, goes in, just starts messing with the stuff. And then Doc knows to call him at the house.
Right. So clearly this is a morning ritual of Marty's.
Yeah.
And he's going over early, because if he's got to be at school at 8 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
and he wants to go over and play with the guitar for a bit and the speakers, et cetera, he's probably going over around 7:15, 7:30 in the morning, at least. But yeah, you're right.
And then they have a conversation. He's like, hey, come to the mall at 1:15 in the morning.
Right.
And there's no argument about it. It's like, okay, I'll do it. And then, you know, hey, come go by the house and pick up the camera. No problem, going to do it. So that the relationship is so, because you think Marty's only 17.
Right.
We don't really know how old Doc is. We'll say early 50s, maybe late 50s.
I put him in his 60s, actually. Okay. But that's just based on looks.
I was trying to be nice.
Because then, I mean, he's going back 30 years, and in 1955, Doc looks to be at least.
Oh, that's true.
In his late, he's got to be in his 40s, right?
Okay.
So yeah, I thought he was closer to 70, to be honest. Yeah. I put him at 68, I think was my guesstimate.
All right. I was trying to be nice, but that sounds right.
But that was another problem I have, is just that Christopher Lloyd is ageless. Like, he looks like he's been 65 years old for the past 40 years. I know. It's the Wilford Brimley effect.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. They're ageless.
So yeah, he asked Marty to come 1:15 with the camera. Doesn't explain anything, but Marty's coming. So that just shows that there's a friendship there. And when did this start? How did this start?
I love it. It's a great point. Yeah.
So Marty shows up at the mall and he sees Einstein, Doc's dog. And of course he's asking, where's Doc? And then you just have that great, because the music starts and you see this truck and the pack opens and all this, the smoke starts coming out.
Great smoke. Yeah.
And you hear the rev of the engine. You're like, oh, what is this? And the ramp comes down and out comes the DeLorean. You're, oh, wow. This is so freaking cool.
Yeah. It's pretty unique.
And then Doc asks Marty to start recording. And basically Doc has told Marty he has invented time travel. He's invented time travel. He's been working on this forever. And he's finally going to do the first test to prove that time travel actually works. And it's amazing because there's kind of the sci-fi element to it, but it's explained in such a way that layman's terms that we get it. And the whole experiment is he's literally going to send Einstein his dog 1 minute into the future. And then they will literally catch up with Einstein, basically meet up with them in the present. And the whole thing that they need plutonium, and how do you get plutonium? And then he has to explain the whole thing with the, you know, how to double cross the Libyans in order to get it. Does the whole thing with the stopwatches, that they're at the same time. And then they put Einstein in the car, and then the car, for some reason, has to get up to 88 miles per hour. And that was cool too, that he could actually remote control the car.
Oh, awesome. I thought
that was amazing.
Totally awesome. Yeah.
So he sends Einstein off. Boom. Of course, Marty thinks he literally blew up the car and Einstein's gone, but he's like, no. And Doc literally has to push them out of the way, because then the car jumps back into the present. Einstein's okay. Einstein's actually traveled in time. And now Doc is going to go, I think it's into the future, right? At that point.
That's his plan. He wants to go to about 30 years into the future. Right.
He wants to see what, time is like after he would pass away. And then, unfortunately, the quote that you were saying about, they found me, and the Libyans show up, kill Doc in front of Marty. And then you think, oh, Marty's going to bite it too. But luckily the gun jams and Marty jumps into the car trying to escape and inadvertently sends himself 30 years into the past. It's just so fun. There's just so much happening. And it's so exciting.
It's amazing.
Because Doc is explaining to him how the time machine works, and you can set different dates. And you're going to go back to the birth of Christ, or
December 25th, 0000.
Right. Yeah.
The birth of Christ. I love it.
Or the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And then the day he discovered that time travel was possible. And that's the date that stays on there. And Marty accidentally turns it on when he's trying to escape from the Libyans. And then, boom, gets sent to the past, where the mall is now a tree farm and
Peabody farm.
Yes. Which is hilarious too.
Breed the pine trees.
Yes. And I love that line, because he has the radiation suit on. So of course they think he's an alien, and then he tries to flip the hat up and the kid just like, dad, kill him. Look, he's mutating into humanoid form. I love that.
Oh, it's so great.
The initial time travel experiment is just so much fun, and it comes off as believable. That's the thing too, it comes off as believable. The only shot that stinks is the fire burn marks from the car, and you can tell they're not standing over that. It's a bad fire effect.
That's right. That's the one shot there in it. Yeah, it's when the lines of fire go through their legs, that initial after the car disappears with Einstein in it the very first time.
Right. And he talks about the flux capacitor, but he doesn't get in the minutiae of how the flux capacitor works. You just buy it. It's like, okay, it's flux capacitor, whatever this thing does, it makes a DeLorean jump through time. You don't care. You're just fascinated by the fact that, hey, he's been time machine out of a DeLorean, and he sent his dog into the future, and then they caught up with the dog. I love it.
Bill, this was my first favorite scene.
Yeah.
You nailed it. Absolutely. I just wrote down Marty escapes in the DeLorean. that's how I named the scene. But yeah, I put down entire scene at Twin Pines Mall, even all the way into Peabody's farm.
Yeah.
Everything about this is amazing. Like you said, there's so much packed into this scene. I think of as a kid too, I loved it. Just when Marty shows up to an empty mall parking lot at 1:15 a.m., how fun that would be as a kid, like a 17-year-old kid, to go meet up with your crazy scientist buddy. Because I love how you talk about it. I would love to see a prequel. I'm not asking for it.
I don't want to see it.
I still would be interested to know how that relationship came to be, because it is kind of strange. But anyway, it's still cool that he's going to go meet up with Doc in the middle of the night at this empty parking lot. It's just, there's something adventurous and mysterious about that fascinated me as an 11-year-old kid watching this in the summer of 85. You talked about the music. The introduction of DeLorean is awesome. And we get introduced to the flux capacitor. I mean, how many times is that referenced still today in like popular culture for random reasons, whenever discussing time travel, right? I'd even mentioned Endgame, the Back to the Future is.
Oh, yeah.
How many times in that movie?
Yes.
Right. I mean, this is quintessential time travel movie. The music. You said when the music comes in and we see the DeLorean, but later on, this is something I picked up on too, is when it's just great because, first of all, I just want to talk about, ladies and gentlemen, just watch this movie as soon as you can. If you haven't seen it in a while, watch it again. Watch the performances. When I talked about the chemistry between Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox, this is a prime example because they are firing on all cylinders in the scene. You can tell they have a built-in relationship. The looks that they're constantly giving throughout to each other, the fascination and wonder on Marty's face as he's learning that time travel exists is amazing. How he's videotaping Doc the whole time and can't, like, he'll put the camera down, but then has to refocus, but yeah, he's freaking out the whole time. He'll have the camera pointed in the right direction, but then look at Doc Brown off to the side, like out of the, like sideways. And Doc Brown has some great facial expressions. Just watch their faces. Talk about suspension of disbelief. We're talking about some ridiculous shit here, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous. It's batshit. And they sell it because they think it's crazy too. Marty McFly, Michael J. Fox, in the moment, thanks to his performance, sells it. He's like, this is insane. What is happening right now?
Yeah, because if that scene doesn't work, the rest of the movie does not. It falls apart from then on out.
This is in a huge, big, inciting moment, right? This is what sets off the whole series of events that this movie is. And going back to the music, when Marty's videotaping, and then all of a sudden Einstein, who wonderfully at this point is wearing a radiation suit of his own, the dog inside of the van, he starts barking and we see Doc look up and Marty doesn't know what he's looking at. And that's when he says the line, "Oh my God, they found me. I don't know how, but they found me." And at this point already, talking about the music, the score, there's a kind of a march happening. There's a drum roll happening and it's the, and it's been going on as Doc has been explaining the process and the plutonium and all these things are unfolding. And it's great. Just this drum roll kind of in the background, this kind of march. Then he looks up and he sees the Libyan terrorist van coming down the street with no headlights on. The headlights come on. And that's what he says, "Oh my God, they found me." And then the drums start getting, it gets louder and it gets louder. And it's just like, oh my God, it's getting tense. Here we go. The shit is about to hit the fan. Doesn't even Doc earlier in this scene say, "Marty, get ready. You're about to see some serious shit." Yeah. But then the shit hits the fan and the scene is just rock and roll from then on in. I get excited talking about it, man, because this is what it's about. It's just great filmmaking. It's really intense. So also an emotional moment within this scene is when you kind of touched on it with Doc saying, you know, I think I'm going to go 30 years into the future. I want to see how technology has progressed. I mean, he's a scientist, right?
Yeah.
And then Marty almost gets choked up and he kind of puts the camera down and he goes, "Hey, you know, look me up when you're there." Because in that moment, it made me think, oh, I wonder if was Doc planning on coming back anytime soon, or was he just going to go 30 years into the future and stay there for an extended period of time? And Marty, in this moment, was like, oh my gosh, I might be saying goodbye to one of my best friends right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that.
It's a great moment if you catch it. This is why I like, you know, rewatching these classics, when you catch these subtle things, and it's a credit to the performances. There's some very subtle things, especially a nice little foreshadowing here, or when Doc drops the fact, he's like, oh, I almost forgot to pack more plutonium.
Yeah.
Because how am I going to get back without more plutonium? Of course, he doesn't have time to. And that's why Marty gets stuck in the past. So many great moments. And once Marty's in the DeLorean and cruising around, man, it's just cool. I didn't find this in the research. Why did they decide on 88 miles per hour?
Oh, I don't know either.
I don't know why they decided on that number.
Yeah, I couldn't figure that out.
So please let us know if you know the answer to that. That's somewhere in the research or trivia out there. Listeners, please let us know.
I wish I could find out, because like I said, the chemistry between Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox is amazing.
Yeah.
I understood why they cast Michael J. Fox. And this isn't a knock on Christopher Lloyd, because he's iconic as Doc Brown.
Right.
What made them think to cast him in that movie? Yeah, he did Taxi.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like he was people knew who he was, but he wasn't like a huge name.
Right.
But that just kept going through the whole time. I'm like, who was the genius that realized Christopher Lloyd is going to be perfect for this role? It's iconic role. This is what he is known for.
Absolutely.
I just love it. It just, oh God, it just works. It just, that whole movie, I'm just watching, I'm like, God, whoever realized they should cast him as Doc, just,
Yeah, it's a stroke of genius. Absolutely. Yeah. And they work so well off of each other, Lloyd and Fox, and they bring such physicality to the roles too. Michael J. Fox, you know, is a little bit smaller in stature, but man, he is a great physical comedian as well. There's so many subtle things that he does, whether it's stuff with the radiation suit mask, that helmet, that, you know, the way he looks in it. There's a great moment when he travels back into the past and he's basically crashed into the barn on the Peabody farm, and he steps out and he has the mask up at this point, and he's calling out saying, hey, sorry, you know, I kind of, you know, I just could use some help or whatever. And the shotgun blast goes right.
He
falls backwards and trips. It's great. It's so funny to me. And he has a lot of those moments in this movie.
When he's putting on his pants.
He has a great physicality.
Yes, he does. And that's something I really noticed watching this time too. It's like, it's just his body language. There's just something about it. It bounces along with the movie. It just, God, it just fits.
This being our favorite scene. And then we talk about him getting to the Peabody farm. Now he's in the past. The farm owner and his family, they're all freaking out, thinking he's an alien. He hops into, I love that cut too, when he's back into the DeLorean, he bursts out of the barn.
Yes.
This is a great little moment here. A lot of people now know this, and you can read about it. It's just a trivia thing where in this scene, it starts at the Twin Pines Mall in the present day. He is sent back into the past. Now, where that Twin Pines Mall is in the future is where in the past, it's actually just this Peabody farm. And we see, as Marty escapes the farm, he drives over a tree. There's two pine trees, twin pines, and he drives over one of them. And you hear, Peabody go, my pine. So then, little trivia that I hadn't picked up on for the longest time is at the very end, when he comes back to the future, it's no longer the Twin Pines Mall. It's the Lone Pine Mall.
I did not catch the first time either. It was multiple times until I finally saw that.
Yeah,
I missed that one too. Just that little thing just makes that movie so great on repeat viewings.
So that whole scene, great stuff, man.
All right, so what do you got for your next favorite scene? Let's see if we match on this one.
I'm actually going to call it, because I've got some favorite moments too.
All right, go for
it. Before I get to my next favorite scene, I'm just going to call it one moment when we see George McFly in the past. This is Crispin Glover playing a young George McFly, and he's quirky and weird and nervous and very breathy in his line delivery. And, you know, Marty is back there now trying to groom him and trying to build his confidence so that George can ask Lorraine to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. because this has to happen. They have to go to the dance and they have to have their first kiss in order for them to consummate the relationship and thus have give birth to Marty and his brother and sister. So they exist in the future. So as Marty is building George's confidence, they go to the diner where they know Lorraine is sitting with her friends so that George can ask Lorraine to dance. And I just love this because he's built up George's confidence and gave him some good lines to say to Lorraine. Just a small moment. He walks up to the counter.
I've always loved this one. Go ahead.
And says, "Lou, give me a milk. Chocolate." You just see the chocolate milk slide down the bar and he grabs it and picks it up and chugs it just a little bit of it and slams it back down on the counter.
Yeah.
And then wipes off his hand on his mouth. Ah, freaking love that moment every time. Just wanted to give it a shout out.
Yeah, just that it comes in so fast. And I even remember saying to my wife, I'm like, he doesn't even ask for a malt, just chocolate milk.
He goes, "Luke, give me a milk. Chocolate." Yep. Slides then, in.
Boom.
Slides right into frame. You don't even see Lou. It comes off camera. He just slides into frame. He grabs it. It's like such a smooth move. He's just so ultra confident in that moment.
Yeah.
And Bill Bant, I want to try that at a bar and see if anyone gets it. Like today, I want to go into a bar and just ask the bartender. I'll just call the bartender if it's male, female, whomever. I'm going to call him Lou. I don't care what their actual name is. I'll just be like, "Lou, give me a milk. Chocolate." See if the bartender or anybody sitting at the bar gets it. So on to my next favorite scene. This for me is actually when Marty and Doc, no, Marty and Doc scenes for me, Marty and Doc rehearse their plan to get Marty back to the future. I just love this scene.
That's funny too. I love this scene, but it actually went into my complaint department too, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. It's just always been fun for me because they know how they're going to get Marty back. Of course, we know in the story now that because what happened in the beginning of the film, we understand that lightning had struck the clock tower on a particular day at a particular time. So when Marty goes into the past, he knows when the lightning's going to hit this clock tower. He knows exactly when it's going to hit. It just hasn't happened yet. But they need to use the lightning in order to charge the DeLorean, which will enable him to time travel. So they're rehearsing their plan and how they're going to figure this all out. And I love that they go into Doc Brown's garage and Doc walks Marty over to this giant,
it's amazing,
detailed model of Hill Valley. If I could have something from this movie, a prop, that would be it. I would love to have that model of the downtown Hill Valley. And he makes a joke. He's like, "Sorry, Marty, I didn't have time to detail it or paint it."
Oh, you know I know.
And Marty's like, it's pretty good. Because it's so elaborate. It looks exactly like it.
Yeah,
it's great. So I love that. There's some great humor, great chemistry between Lloyd and Fox in this particular scene. Lloyd, again, breaks down how they're going to get Marty back. And he says, so the lightning will strike the clock tower at this time, sending electric charge down the wire because they're going to connect an electrical wire from the steeple, basically, or the top of the clock tower that will run all the way down to these street lamps that also has an electrical wire reaching across the lamps. And the DeLorean will drive under the electrical wire. And the DeLorean itself has an extended hook that will hit the electrical wire at the exact moment the lightning is running through it. Thus, the electrical charge will then run down into the flux capacitor on the DeLorean and charge it up and send it back to the future. They explain it in that scene. It sounds cool. It looks cool. You have the DeLorean kind of with all this crap on it in his garage, and they kind of play it out. So Doc has a little, one of those little cars that you would kind of, this one has a little motor that you twist, right? You twist.
Yeah, a little wind-up car, yeah.
Wind-up, thank you. And it has the hook on the back of it. He sends an electrical charge through it and rehearses it. Like, he actually practically does it, but on a small scale with this model and this tiny model car. The car sets a fire, runs off the table where the models, the whole set is on, and then runs across the floor and sets some
really rags,
on fire. And it has then was one of my favorite expressions ever of Christopher Lloyd when he's like, ooh! He does. Yep. This thing. I just love that. And I'll never forget watching this with my dad, and my dad would always crack up at that moment. He just thought that was so funny when Christopher Lloyd makes it.
Oh, yeah. It's a funny payoff.
It's great. So the plan should work. And they did it, and they put out the fire. And at the same time, who shows up but Lorraine? Because they're going over the plan, which is all great, how to get Marty back, but it's not going to make any difference unless Marty gets George and Lorraine together. His parents have to get hooked up here, and he's got to kind of make it happen. And it's not working out so far because Lorraine has a serious crush on Marty, on her own son. Very weird. Mm-hmm. Something we just kind of have to get over in this movie. It's kind of creepy, but... And Lorraine has followed Marty back to Doc's garage, and she knocks on the door, and she's there now. She actually asks Marty to go to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. And he's like, wait, didn't George ask you? Don't you want to go with George? He really likes you.
Actually, she asked him to ask her to take her to the dance.
Good point. So it's a really awkward scene, but I love the fact that at the end, she's saying, well, George is, you know, he's kind of cute and all, but a real man should, you know, take me or whatever it is. And she's like, don't you think? And he's getting kind of, Marty is getting back to the corner because behind him, Christopher Lloyd is leaning across the DeLorean.
It's awesome. Yeah.
And it's a great moment because Marty then puts his shoulder up on the back of Christopher Lloyd. And it's a small thing, but for me, I love those types of moments because they're actually touching and they kind of have, there's a mentor mentee relationship here, is maybe a fatherly relationship even, but they're great friends. Marty's comfortable enough to put his shoulder on the back of Christopher on Doc Brown in this really awkward moment, kind of like I'm relying on my friend here in this moment, being, you know, kind of intimidated almost by Lorraine. It's a great physical moment. I love that scene. That's my take.
No, that is a fun scene. Yeah, my only issue with that scene is, why did Doc have to put the charge through the poles? I'm saying, what were they expecting to happen? I mean, the payoff is hilarious because it sets the car on fire and then sets the garage on fire. He's not going to send the mini car back to the future.
I think it was, to me, I always assumed just to prove that it would work.
Right.
That the electrical, that the electric charge would actually run through all the wires and okay. hit the hook at the same time, that it would actually.
I'm wondering what the actual result should have been.
Oh, yeah. It's not as if he's expecting.
Yeah, that's what I was like, why send electricity through that and start the fire? But it's funny.
Right, it's a funny little bit, though. It's definitely reckless. And yes. It's like, yeah, what were you expecting to happen kind of thing? But I think it was just to prove that the wires would work as a conduit for the electricity. That's all.
I love that scene too. It is a fun scene. Okay, so for me, my next favorite scene is the skateboard chase.
Oh, sure. Good call. Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
So this almost piggybacks onto your moment there where Marty has convinced George to ask Lorraine out because Marty showed up at George's house in the hazmat suit and gave the whole, I'm Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan, and you have to ask Lorraine out or I'm going to melt your brain. So he's used the fear tactic basically to make sure that George is going to ask out Lorraine. And of course, you know, George's nervous. He doesn't know what to ask. So Marty gives him some lines, the density line, which I always loved. I am your density, but
what?
So George has got the current. He goes up to Lorraine, blowing his lines, but he's sticking in there. He's sticking in there like, okay, he's going to do this. He's going to do this. And then, of course, Biff and his buddies show up. Oh, shit. What are we going to do now? And Biff, of course, had told George earlier in the film that not to come in that diner anymore. He's going to beat the crap out of him. And while he's walking over to George, Marty trips him to take the focus off of George, and now it's going to be on Marty. And Marty, of course, he's outnumbered 4-1. He's going to get his butt beaten in. And hey, what's that over there? Punch him and run off. And now the chase. Marty's trying to run away and realizes he's not going to be able to outrun these four, and sees kids in the old classic box scooters. Like, I remember those. Like, even when I was a kid, people were still making those. I mean, you definitely don't see them now because now you can get the nice little Razor scooters.
Right.
Instead of using the scooter itself, he literally breaks in half and makes it into a skateboard and uses his skateboard maneuvers to escape from Biff and his henchmen.
From Biff and Billy Zane.
Yes. And Casey Simasco.
Oh, yeah.
And the other guy. It's so hilarious. You're like, oh, my God, you got Billy Zane, Casey Simasco, and the other guy. You know, he's doing his thing, like you saw in the beginning of the movie, where he's latching on to the cars to go through. And, of course, the whole town is like, they've never seen anything like this. They haven't seen a skateboard. They haven't seen someone trailing behind a truck like that in a skateboard. Of course, it's backfiring in the sense of now Lorraine is just, because she had said earlier in the earlier scene that she wants a strong man to date. And here it is. Marty's just stood up to Biff and his boys, and he beats them because he basically maneuvers them in the back of a manure truck, and the manure truck dumps all the manure into their car, basically stopping them, and Marty gets away. It was just cool. Watching the theater, I'm like, oh, I got to get a skateboard now. I got to learn to skateboard right? Like that. That's just so cool. But yeah, it's just a fun little action piece in the film. I just found it fun. It's just...
It's a blast, man.
Yeah.
It's a blast. It's a great call. Good call, man. And like you said, it's a creative use of resources. We talked a little bit about this with Indiana Jones too, with Raiders Lost Ark, where it's like, okay, where... We have an action set piece that takes place here in this space. How do we use what we have in a creative way? How do we choreograph in a creative way and make it original, fresh, using things we've all seen before that we recognize? We know what cars do and skateboards do and et cetera, but we've got to make this fun and fresh. And that's what they did, and they nailed it. That scene is so much fun. It's just great. And because also, you know, of the circumstances that like these two little kids haven't seen anybody do anything with a skateboard before like that, as they're witnessing Marty cruising around on it and on the back of cars and stuff. And then when he does the cool stunt, when he just lets the skateboard go underneath the vehicle and he climbs over the car and jumps mm-hmm. back onto it. It's like one of the coolest moves ever.
Yep.
Such a great ending to that action piece. It's awesome. My only thing is with this particular scene is that watching it, here's a then and now kind of thing. Now, watching it on a big screen TV in ultra HD, you can clearly see the stuntmen in place of Marty in particular cuts. It's a little bit weird or it's a little bit obvious, but it's so quick. And again, it's just, you just go with it. It's really well choreographed. And what a great payoff to have Biff, the ultimate bully, get shit dumped on him at the end.
Yep.
You know, it's just, manure. And we talk about how influential this movie is. We have the Book of Boba Fett out right now on Disney Plus. Spoiler alert. Once again, pause for the next 30 seconds or so if you don't want any spoilers for the Book of Boba Fett. But in episode 3, have you seen it yet, Bill?
Yes, I saw episode 3.
There's an entire speeder chase through, is it Mos Espa?
Espa, yes.
That is an almost outright homage to two different action set pieces from the Back to the Future franchise. This one in particular, the skateboard chase, and also the hoverboard action set piece in Back to the Future 2.
Mm-hmm.
That speeder chase in episode 3 of the Book of Boba Fett is an homage. Like, it's blatant. And in my opinion,
not
unsuccessful,
done as well.
Yes. Not done as well. And some of the effects are actually worse. It's surprising, but that's just my opinion. I don't know what happened, but at least they were trying to pay homage to a great movie. And this particular scene that you chose is one of your favorite scenes, because at the end of the speeder chase, he crashes into something and it dumps a bunch of crap on top of him. Anyway,
it's a fruit. I can't remember the name of it,
but that's Back to the Future is still with us in popular culture today.
Yep.
It's great to see, you know, people still respect the hell out of this movie. But it did it. Back to the Future did it first. So great scene, man. Yeah. Some other great moments. We did the opening quote of our podcast here with a, "Hey, you get your damn hands off her." I love that moment when George McFly is rehearsing what he's going to do with Marty, because they have it all set up. They're like, Marty's telling, okay, here's the plan. At 8:55, where are you? I'm at the dance. And he's like, okay, what happens then at 9 o'clock? He's like, I'm going to come to the car and you're going to be doing your thing. And Marty's like, yeah. He's like, well, what's going to be happening? He's like, well, girls don't like it when you do something inappropriate or something along those lines. And Crispin Glover is just hilarious. Again, so breathy in his line, everything. And he's like, oh, you mean you're going to touch her? He's like, no, no, George, don't. There's so this whole back and forth with, because they're carrying laundry and stuff. And
yeah, he's holding a bra. Yeah. At that point.
And also Marty almost slips and he calls him dad. He's like, dad, dad, daddy-o. Yeah. And then it comes to the point. It's like, okay, then at 9 o'clock you come to the car and I'm harassing Lorraine and you're going to save the day. And what's your line? What's your line, George? And he says, hey, you get your damn hands off her. You think I really ought, you know, do I really ought to have to swear? He says, yes, God damn it, George, swear. I love that moment. It makes me laugh every single time. Another moment is that moment you were talking about, I think earlier, it's right before the dance. Doc is prepping the scene with the DeLorean. He's prepping all the electrical wire running down from the clock tower. And he has a really nice moment there with Marty, because they're talking about, you know, is everything set to go? And Marty again, once again, is like, hey, you really need to know what happens in the future. And Doc's like, I don't want to know. Actually, right before that moment is what the moment I want to bring up here is Doc says to him, well, Marty, I'm going to miss you. And Marty says, I'm really going to miss you. And that chokes me up every time.
Yeah.
Because Marty knows that he dies in the future, that Doc dies. It's like, I really, and that's when Doc knows, senses that. And he's like, don't tell me what happens. I don't want to be responsible for knowing too much and then affecting what happens in the future. It's very touching. It's very touching. I love that moment when Marty says, I'm really going to miss you. Love that. And of course, the iconic moment when George knocks out Biff. What a great moment when Biff gets his comeuppance, as you said, Bill Bant, earlier. Love that moment. It's great storytelling. It's the way it's all set up, how Marty is been drug off and thrown in a trunk, and then now George is having to face off with Biff, and Lorraine is, and it's really high stakes at that moment.
Oh yeah.
Because Biff is not a good dude. And credit to Leah Thompson as Lorraine, she's really in a bad place. Something bad's about to go down, and George interrupts, and you think George's really going to get his ass kicked, and he's about to get his arm broken. It's great that there's a brief moment when he goes to punch Biff in the stomach, and Biff literally catches his punch and twists his arm around his back as if he's going to break his arm. It's well choreographed, and it's very intense. And then George musters up the confidence and the energy to swing around and punch him with his other hand and knock him out. And it's just a really, it's a great hero moment.
Oh yeah.
And the music kicks in and the whole thing. And now Lorraine is in love with him. And it's just great.
Yeah. It was so fun how all that worked out. I remember seeing it the first time. You're thinking, you know, Michael J. Fox's plan, of course, is going to work. And it's not, because his mom's not what he expects. And then you think, oh, so what's going to happen now when George shows up? And then you see it's Biff and you're like, oh, shit.
He's a big dude.
Yeah.
By the way, I actually, when I was waiting tables, Thomas F. Wilson, he came in once.
Oh, did he?
And he is a big guy. Yeah. You're like, oh, yeah, there he is. There's Biff.
Yes. Here's another YouTube moment. YouTube, Tom Wilson talking about Back to the Future. He does a whole bit about it's a song. It's called Stop Asking Me the Questions that he sings about, because people are always asking questions about the movie. Like what Michael J. Fox, and he's like, nice, you know, because everyone thinks they still all hang out, and he's like, that's not how it happens. But he does a whole song parody of it, and it's hilarious.
Oh, so if you can find
it, yeah, you got to check it out. It's funny.
And ladies and gentlemen, please remember, this whole movie is one favorite scene and a trillion different favorite moments. These are just some that stuck out to me upon watching it again, because I just wish we had time to go over every single moment of this movie. But I'll go ahead to the next. It's a scene technically, but I'm just putting it as a moment, as the Johnny B. Goode scene. It's just great. It's iconic. Michael J. Fox doing his best fake guitar playing.
Yes.
And lip syncing. Great moment with was it Marvin Berry and the Starlights, right?
Yes. Which is hilarious in the credits. It says songs by Marvin Berry and the Starlights. So you don't even really know who it is that does the music.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. But the classic scene when Marvin Berry goes off to the side and calls his cousin, I guess, right?
Yeah.
He's like, this is your cousin, Marvin. But he calls Chuck Berry. So, hey, you knew that's that great. New sound you're looking for? well, listen to this. And it's Marty playing Johnny B. Goode. It's just great fun. And then, of course, Marty decides to go nuts and goes off on his solo riff on his guitar. And I guess you're just not ready for that yet when the kids are all freaked out by him just jamming. Mm-hmm. But and kicking over the speaker, going full rock star. That's a great moment. I love immediately following that they don't dwell on his embarrassment too much. It just cuts to him leaving the high school gym, and Lorraine and George kind of want to say their goodbyes really quick.
Yeah.
Because they get this, like, Calvin/Marty is about to leave, and Michael J. Fox is like, yeah, it's been educational. Some great Silvestri music comes in here. Nice moment when he's like, hey, if you ever have a kid and when he's about 8 years old and he happens to set fire to the rug, just go easy on him. That's just a really nice moment. Then we're about to get into some serious shit, as Doc Brown would say.
Oh, yeah.
So this goes to now my actual favorite scene, which is Marty goes back to the future.
Oh, yeah. And that's all mine, too. So
it's this whole entire finale, which is amazing with all that happens. We talked about the Twin Pines Mall scene when Marty goes to the past and how much was packed into this scene. It feels like that's quadrupled in this finale with all the drama that happens, because Marty shows up and now he's got his modern day clothes back on and he's ready to go back to the future. He's going to get sent home. And the lightning is about to strike. And what's great here is the time constraint, which just adds so much pressure and intensity to this scene. And you have Doc Brown, who has everything rigged. Everything's set to go. And the wind is blowing because the storm is coming. And we know it's a thunderstorm. There's going to be lightning. And just hijinks after hijinks ensue. And the intensity builds because Marty really wants to tell Doc that he's going to die in the future. And Doc has gotten hold of the letter because Marty at this point has written a letter to Doc telling him that what the events that are going to unfold in the future. But he tells it he writes on the envelope, don't open until 1985. But Doc finds the envelope in his pocket and says, no, I don't want to know. And he tears up the envelope. And now Marty's distraught, but time's running out. He's got to get into the DeLorean and run off. But we've got some problems because the tree falls over, yanking one of the electrical lines and pulling it out of the cable out of the plug at the top near the clock at the very top of the tower. And so now Doc's got to go all the way up into the tower, up to the clock, and put the cable back into the plug so everything's connected. And it's just then Marty's at the ground level trying to yell up to him, you get shot in the future. You get shot. You need to know.
Yeah.
And lightning is striking and thunder is happening. So Doc can't hear him. And then Marty runs to the DeLorean to get in the DeLorean and cruises up the street to get a head start before he drives back down and to hook the line onto them. Anyway, basically Doc Brown at the top finally gets the cable back. He yanks it hard enough, gets the cable back into the plug. But then on the other end, it unplugs and is hooked onto a tree at the ground level. So Doc's got to go all the way back down. And meanwhile, now Marty sees the clock's ticking down. He's got to hit the gas in a minute. Try starting the DeLorean. The DeLorean is stalled. Now it's either the engine's flooded or whatever. It's stalled. Yeah. He's out of gas. He's out of juice.
Now it's not the first time that's happened. Yeah.
Right. So we've just got issue upon issue upon issue. Of course, Marty bangs his head on the steering wheel. The car magically starts up. It's great. Perfect timing. He hits the gas, gets up to 88 miles per hour, just in time for Doc to get to the ground level and plug in all the wires, and the lightning strikes, runs through. Thankfully, the lightning doesn't kill Doc as this happens. And the DeLorean disappears with the streaks of fire on the street. And just love this moment too, because then you have this really quiet moment, because then now the DeLorean has disappeared and then Doc is just running down the street. He's like, oh, yeah, like it was successful. And it just builds and builds and builds. It's a great scene. It's just awesome. The music is awesome. Again, the drums, the theme, it's just the thunder, the lightning, the sound design. By the way, just the way the DeLorean sounds, just the engine and the electricity. Yeah. It's great. Love those sound effects.
It's kind of got that land speeder kind of.
Very much so. Yeah. I don't know if you have anything to add to that because there's just so much going on.
Part that I loved watching it this time was, you know, the tree falls on the cable, which disconnects, of course, the connector all the way up by the damn clock. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Doc runs up there with the rope and throws it down. And Marty just ties the cable onto the rope and sends it back up, not knowing that now the cable is not going to be long enough. Right, but I thought about that, too. And I was like, you know what? I probably would have done the same thing. I never would have put it together that he wasn't going to have enough cable.
Right. Because the tree is on top of the cable, pulling it down further.
And that even made it more fun for me because I'm like, yeah, I would have done the same thing. I wouldn't have tried to rope the cable around the tree. I just would have sent it back up because, I mean, he literally has, what, 6 minutes?
Yeah. The time constraint is really tight. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought of it in the moment either. It'd be like, no, we just got to go as quickly as possible.
And then I just remember just being on the edge of my seat in the theater and just the audience when you think he's going to connect it. And it's like, oh, shit. But it was still fun that he's still got to yank out of the tree, literally sees the DeLorean flying down the street. And it's like, I literally have seconds to plug this back in.
And it's one of those things where, you know, it's most likely going to work out. But it's just again, how they choreographed and set up this whole action set piece is just, it's wonderful. It's super intense. Mm-hmm. There's so many different elements of it. The dramatic element of it, because Marty's trying to tell Doc about the future. Doc doesn't want to know. So that's super dramatic. But then the car's not starting. The cables are getting unplugged. Like, it was just so many things. And then it's super windy and the thunder and lightning. I mean, it's super dramatic.
Yeah, because you're kind of sad because you're like, oh, he's going to go back and Doc's going to be dead. But then you get so caught up into, oh, my God, is he going to have this rigged in time?
Yeah,
you almost kind of forget about it.
You're also like, Marty, get in the freaking car, man. You got to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because especially when the alarm goes off. Wait, is he still going to make 88 on time? What the hell? Yeah, it's tension filled. It's so much fun. That was definitely one of my favorite scenes, too.
Well, that's all I've got. What else do you have, if anything, for favorite scenes?
No, that was it. Well, we can move on. All right, so our next segment is soundtrack to Back to the Future. As we mentioned earlier, composer was Alan Silvestri. And confession, I just assumed because this is a Spielberg production, it was John Williams, and it was a couple of years till I realized it was Alan. I apologize about that. But yeah, this is one of my favorite themes of all time. I freaking love this, and I wish it was Williams, just so I could hear it live at some point, because I freaking love it.
Oh, 100%. And I've been a fan of Alan Silvestri probably, since this particular film. Now, our second podcast we've ever done was Romancing the Stone, which I remember mentioning then. Alan Silvestri and Robert Zemeckis have teamed up on a few different things. And Romancing the Stone is similar. When the credits come up, there's a music cue that's immediately recognizable, at least it was to me, that it's Alan Silvestri. And that's something I wanted to mention here, because at the top, I had talked about just those three notes, the bum, bum, bum. I don't even know if that's the right tone, but you get the idea. You're familiar with it, how recognizable it is. But there's another Alan Silvestri signature that I love that you hear at the beginning of the Romancing the Stone, as well as here, where it's a light chime mixed with bells. It's very light, and it's basically like a musical version of Pixie Dust.
And that's what you're talking about.
That's the analogy I make, because when you hear that sound, that music cue, because you can't really sing it, but you know it, you hear it, it's like a musical version of magic, like I said, like fairy dust.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you said.
So you,
like a spell's about to happen or something.
Right, exactly. You hear that and you're immediately transported. It is magical. So you got Huey Lewis's song, The Power of Love. I'm talking about just the power of the score, the power of Silvestri's music in this. It really transports you into this world, but it makes you believe. I was listening to the soundtrack today in my car, and of course, always do this. I'm just like, please bring back the thematic soundtrack. I want themes. I want every character to have a theme. I want marches. I want action themes. I want romantic themes. I want a title theme. I want end credits theme compilations. I want all of it. Alan Silvestri nails it with this one. One of the most recognizable themes. It's right up there with Jaws and Indiana Jones, E.T., Superman, Star Wars. Back to the Future is right up there. It's so awesome. I recommend listening to this soundtrack. You can get the extended soundtrack. There was the, you know, very original one, which had a lot of the lyrical songs on there. Huey Lewis has the two big tracks, as yep. well as there's some other random ones. Do yourself a favor. And after you listen to this podcast, because you must listen to this entire 5-hour podcast first. That's not true at all. But after listening to our podcast, pull up your favorite 80s movie orchestral soundtrack and listen to it wherever you are and try not to smile. Just try. Whether it's RoboCop, Empire Strikes Back, Back to the Future, just do it. Listen to it and be inspired by it. See where it takes your imagination. That's what I like to do. It feels great. Makes me feel like a kid. That's part of the reason why we do this podcast, Bill. This is the music from the movies of the 80s is such a huge thing for me. So because it still makes me want to run around my house like an action star or drive really fast to get away from the bad guys and save the girl. It's pure, unadulterated, innocent fun. It's just so inspiring. So yeah, Alan Silvestri, you know, it's funny too, there's some music cues in this with the drums, which is very similar to the Predator score, which he did as well.
Right, yeah.
Which is great, because I can hear that in my head too. But you can now listen to the entire Alan Silvestri score without any of the lyrical songs on it. Just you can find it. I listen to it on YouTube Music. That's just me. I'm sure you can find it in a lot of different places. But speaking of the music, we talk about Huey Lewis. Talk about feel good music. I don't know about you, man, but I had the Sports album. I mean, that's
no, I did. Yeah,
Huey Lewis and the News Sports, man, had that on a cassette. If this is it, I want a new drug. Heart of Rock and Roll, Heart and Soul. Come on, man.
They contributed the two songs to the soundtrack, Back in Time and Power of Love. And I remember leaving the theater thinking Back in Time was going to be a huge hit. Wow, I was totally wrong on that one. I mean, it's still charted number 12 at some point, but The Power of Love did reach number one on the Billboard charts for 2 weeks. And I did get to see Huey Lewis in concert.
Awesome.
That's great. About 9 years ago at the OC Fair. And yeah, he made a joke. It's like, I know why everyone is here. And we've played the song thousands of times and they did Power of Love, which was amazing to hear it live. Of course, it sucks now that Huey Lewis can't perform anymore because now he has like a inner ear disorder. It happened to him a couple of years ago when he was doing a concert, and so he can't hold vocal pitches because of it. So he's basically had to retire from performing. It sucks.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, there's no way to correct it. It just kind of stinks. So I'm happy I was able to get to see him and hear him.
That's great, man.
That song live. So.
I'm a fan.
Yeah.
But it was just very easy going, feel good music, you know?
Yeah.
Very identifiable with the 80s. And he's got a nice little cameo in this movie.
Yes. I didn't catch that for the longest time either.
He's one of the judges in the beginning when Marty McFly and his band.
Pinheads.
The Pinheads. They're doing like a little battle of the bands to see who's going to play, I guess, for the dance, for their dance in present day. Right.
Yeah.
And they don't get very far into their, they're actually playing The Power of Love, aren't they?
Yep. It's got some of the notes in there. Yeah.
It's the electric version of it.
Yes.
Huey Lewis stands up and says, okay, we've basically heard enough. It's just too loud.
Pulls up the microphone. Next. He just looks at everyone else. They don't react at all. It's just microphone comes. Next.
And one of the, last little bit on Huey Lewis, one of the funniest things, speaking of another classic 80s movie, which we will definitely do in the future, that being Die Hard. The terrorists, I guess, in the movie, one of Hans Gruber's gang members looks just like Huey Lewis and is often mistaken as Huey Lewis.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
The beginning of Die Hard. He's sitting behind the desk, basically. Yep. He looks very similar. It's not Huey Lewis, but it does look very similar to him. And I think of Huey Lewis every time I see that actor, you know, in the movie Die Hard. Mm-hmm. It's just funny.
Hello, Bill Band here from the All 80s Movies Podcast to tell you about Factor Meals.
Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Head to factormeals.com/80smovies50 and use code 80smovies50 to get 50% off. That's code 80smovies50 at factormeals.com/80smovies50 to get your 50% off today. All right, so let's move on to our Swiss cheese and complaints apartment. And why do we call it Swiss cheese?
Because although this movie is delicious, it does have holes.
Yes, and if it doesn't fall under Swiss cheese, we just file a complaint with the complaint department. Okay, so I'm just going to say Swiss cheese, it's a time travel movie. There's tons of Swiss cheese.
Right.
We talked a little bit about this already, so I'm just going to move on to Swiss cheese, and let's just go to any complaints we have in the complaint department.
100%. I agree with you wholeheartedly. Thanks for saying that, because I was about to say, I'm just going to, regarding the actual holes in the plot, I'm going to stick my head in a hole like an ostrich and pretend like there isn't any holes, because yeah. I think this movie is perfect. No, but seriously, we're not going to waste anybody's time trying to poke holes in the time travel.
You can discuss a yearly podcast on that. Yeah.
All right. So my first complaint is old person makeup. I have an issue. I just, it's a thing.
I know that's a thing of yours.
Just a freaking thing, man. Although it's a complaint of mine in this film, it's not a serious complaint. It actually gets me upset about old person makeup in modern movies, because even though it's not great in the beginning of Back to the Future, it's much worse in movies today, and it pisses me off. So what I'm talking about in Back to the Future is in the present, in the opening of the movie, when Marty McFly goes, he's going home, and we see George McFly and Lorraine McFly, his parents. It's Crispin Glover and Leah Thompson playing the roles, but they have old person makeup on. They've been aged. And we see Biff as well. So my this ranking
is the worst.
Yeah. So Biff is bad. Lorraine's not great. George is okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think George is pretty good, actually. His is the best. Crispin Glover looks aged appropriately, and it looks realistic. Lorraine is so-so, but yeah, Biff is like pretty rough with the makeup. And I'm like, it's clearly somebody wearing makeup.
Mm-hmm.
The texture is off. It looks unrealistic. So that's my thing. But it's just funny because then you think of, even in modern times, I think of Guy Pearce in Prometheus.
Oh, I know you had a bit it's just to like, think about that. Yeah.
Just looks like shit. Mm-hmm. It's just like, come on, guys. This is a multi-million dollar movie. Let's get the makeup right. Or just don't do it. Don't do it. Why did Guy Pearce need to be that? You know what? Figure a workaround. Figure it out.
Yeah, because Lorraine is supposed to be 47 and she looks like she's 67. They overdid it.
Oh, yeah. How about this? Cast an older actor that looks somewhat like the younger actor. We'll go with it. We'll buy it. We'll just buy into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because that always happens anyway.
Don't put the younger actor in terrible old person makeup. Stop it. Stop it. That's all I have to say. What's your next complaint, man?
All right. Marty McFly's brother and sister. Totally did not buy them as Marty's brother and sister.
Because they look absolutely nothing alike at all.
And, you know, I love Wendy Jo Spencer and Mark McClure, because Wendy Jo Spencer was one of my favorite 80s sitcoms, Bosom Buddies. Always a fan.
Awesome.
But I don't buy at all that they're related.
It's weird casting.
Yes, it is. And then Mark McClure, who we know played Jimmy Olsen
in
Superman films.
Good call. I agree. Yeah. I agree, man. It's a great call. Here's a question for you. Mm-hmm. Do you think Lou, the soda jerk behind the bar at the diner in the 50s in 1955, would he be upset that Marty just recklessly tore a page out of his phone book? phone book doesn't say anything, but
I thought about that.
It always kind of was like, he just blatantly tore a page out of the phone book and then walks right up to him and is asking him where that address is that's on that page, which is Doc Brown's address. And hey, dude, how about you don't destroy my property?
Right. I thought about that. I'm wondering how many people watch this movie for the first time is like, what is he looking through? Do they even know what a phone book is? I don't know.
Totally. That's great. Here's a strange thing that bothered me slightly was that after Marty in that diner scene has met his father in 1955, now the young version of his father, he follows him back to the McFly house and sees that Marty, or it's actually not the, it's not the McFly house. He follows him to the Baines house, his mother, Lorraine's house. And because McFly or George is up in the tree as the peeping Tom. So George McFly falls out of the tree, is about to get hit by Lorraine's father's vehicle. And Marty pushes him out of the way in the last second and then gets hit by the car, falls backward, hits his head, the back of his head on the street, and is knocked unconscious. Wakes up 9 hours later in the bed, and we see a young version of his mom, Lorraine, and she keeps saying that he's got a bruise on his head, and Marty keeps touching like the front of his head, and I keep going, why do that happens like two or three times?
Yeah,
where his head is bruised, like he's looking either he's touching or she's touching his forehead or the side of his head or forehead when he clearly hit the back of his head. Like, why do they keep touching his forehead?
Right. Like at first, head's bruised. Like, yeah, because it almost be like, all right, he probably had a concussion, so he has a headache, but then you wouldn't keep mentioning bruise.
That his head's bruised. Headache.
Yeah.
It's like, no, the back of his head. Yeah. He literally had a concussion. Like he, yeah, like you said. Like, so that was just kind of, it's a very nitpicky here, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Very nitpicky.
All right, here's my last complaint. So Marty goes back to the past, basically breaks up his parents, and he's got to put them back together. Him and Doc can freely walk around the high school. No one questions, like,
you have free reign, it seems. Yeah.
Are you a student here? What are you doing here? No one picks up on the fact that, did he enroll that week? How did that happen?
Is this kind of a just one of the guys kind of thing where.
Yeah. So that I found that kind of unusual.
Also, yeah, you're waiting for Principal Strickland to show up and pull him by the collar again.
Yeah,
you know, he would know
right away. Yeah, he did not belong in that school because that he's a taskmaster. He would know. Right. He's like, what the hell are you doing here? Get out of my school.
Hell yeah. One other nitpicky complaint is the one special effect while Marty is playing guitar with Marvin Berry and the Starlights. Yeah,
that's not a good
one. He has the disappearing hand effect. Mm-hmm. It's not great. He's looking at his hand in front of him, but it looks like his entire hand and arm is disembodied. It's weird.
Yes.
Cool idea. Bought it as a kid. Not so much now. Doesn't quite work.
That's the second worst effect, I think, besides the flames from the car, mm-hmm. them standing on it. That would be, the hand thing. Yeah, that always kind of takes you out of it for a quick moment. All right. You have anything else for Swiss cheese or complaints?
One issue when traveling to the future, like at the end, Doc Brown shows up. This is a very, 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 very end of the movie. Says we need to go back to the future. It seems to me like it's a serious risk when you like would re-enter if you're going into the future and you don't know if you're just going to run into a brick wall or end up inside of a wall or a building because you're going to different time periods when you wouldn't know exactly where you're going to end up.
Yeah, because it falls under...
This is a time travel thing, so forgive me for bringing up a time travel
issue. But it makes sense because I kind of thought about this too. When Marty's going to go back to the future and realizes Doc's not going to listen to him. He's like, all right, I'm going to change when I go back. And he just changes 10 minutes. I'm right. Like, well, why don't you change like hours? Mm-hmm. But then the problem is
the parking lot might be full of cars.
Right. Yeah. That street might be full. He might kill five people coming back in. Maybe you could have got away with maybe going at least back an hour because you think probably the town shuts down around 9 or 10, or he could have went back to at least 11 o'clock where no one's really there. But the fact he just goes back 10 minutes, you should have put a little more time on that. But I understand why you don't go back too far.
Right.
Because, I mean, he takes out the movie theater.
Yeah. Good point. All good points. I think it's kind of cool that they did that in the beginning when they go to the twin, that he goes to the Twin Pines Mall parking lot at 1:15 a.m. That makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
Because the lot's empty. And also, if they're going, even when the fact that they lay the groundwork in the exposition that years earlier, it was just farmland. Mm-hmm. So they know that when he goes back to the bath, he would just end up in the middle of a farm. He's not going to just killing himself.
Because a lot of people were making the joke of when Doc is going through the dates, because it's not like he can travel to a specific area. He can just travel through time where he's at.
Right, right. You can't choose
right
location. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You could choose the time, but you can't choose the location.
Yeah. See, yeah, this is where we get into
right
time travel plot holes. All right, that's all I got.
All right, so let's move on to, hey, it's that actor.
All right.
So in this segment, we spotlight a character actor you could have seen in many other films, an actor making their big screen debut, or an actor that makes an uncredited cameo. So who's your, hey, it's that actor?
All right. So my, hey, it's that actor is Jason Hervey. Jason Hervey plays Milton Baines in the 1955 Timeline. That's Lorraine, Leah Thompson, younger brother. So when we go into the Baines household and Marty is at the dinner table and they're watching TV and he's sitting next to Lorraine, across the table are Lorraine's younger siblings, and Jason Hervey is the one that's asking Marty about reruns. Like, what is a rerun? How could you have seen it? Because Marty's like, oh, I've seen this episode. It's hilarious. And the kid, the younger brother, is like, how could you have seen it? This is brand new. So had a great career in the 80s, just great career all, overall. You know, he goes on to play young Thornton in Back to School. But he is most famously known for playing Wayne Arnold, the older brother to the character of Kevin Arnold in The Wonder Years from 1988 to 1993. That's my, hey, it's that actor, Jason Hervey.
Yes.
Yeah. He did a lot of TV.
I recognize him. I wasn't 100% sure what he was in.
Yeah.
Oh, good call, Back to School, which will be a future podcast also.
Absolutely.
So my, hey, it's that actor is Deborah Harmon, and she was
the
TV newscaster at the beginning of the film.
Yep.
She played the mom in the short-lived 80s comedy Just the 10 of Us, which was a spinoff from Growing Pains. Awesome. And was notorious for having three of the actresses that would be in the Nightmare on Elm Street films. So her big movies was, she was in another Robert Zemeckis film. She was in Used Cars with Kurt Russell.
Awesome.
And she was also in Bachelor Party with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
She was like the best friend who was all against the Bachelor Party. And then she becomes like the hot sex kitten thing. She's like repressed at that point, and then she just goes all buck wild at the end of the movie. So
I just love hearing you say sex kitten.
All right. So yeah. So that's my, hey, it's that actor.
Deborah, good call. Norman. That's great.
All right, so yeah, go ahead.
No, that's all I was going to say, that you want to move on to a little fun facts and trivia?
Yeah, fun facts and trivia. I mean, the big thing, I'm sure everybody knows this.
Yeah, let's have the Eric Stoltz conversation.
Exactly. So Michael J. Fox was originally asked to play Barney McFly in the film, but could not do it because he was contractually obligated to Family Ties.
Correct.
So they asked Eric Stoltz to play Marty McFly, and they have since released some of the footage that you could see, you know, some of the film on it. And I don't know, there's definitely different stories about how long he was actually filming the film until they just decided, it's like, this is just not working out.
Right.
And then they just figured out a way to get Michael J. Fox back. And I think it sounds like he was doing both at the same time, the show during the day, and then he would go film at night, go to sleep, and then just start the process all over again. I mean, when you talk about like film casting, this is definitely one of the biggest stories where it's supposed to be Eric Stoltz and it just didn't work out. And I mean, it's very rare where you hear this happen. I mean, we talked about this on one of our other podcasts with Aliens, where they had James Remar in there for like a week or two. And they're like, this just isn't working, or he was having personal problems. And then they brought in Michael B. in. But this was huge too, because I mean, this really would have been a game changer for Eric Stoltz. And definitely set their careers on totally different path. I mean, Eric Stoltz definitely had a great career. I mean,
he absolutely was
Mask.
He's a great actor.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he's done a ton of stuff. So it's not like he went by the wayside. Yeah, just crazy just to see how different that movie would have been with him in it.
Absolutely. Well, isn't it interesting too? Sorry to cut you off.
No, it's okay.
It's exactly what you were saying earlier, though. It's kind of, you make one decision, one thing happens. Well, let's say Eric Stoltz did play the role of Marty Fly. What would this movie have looked like and been, and how would it have affected his career and then everybody else's career afterward? And how, you know, what kind of box office would this movie have done? And would it still be part of our popular culture? It's, you know, who knows what would have happened? We don't know. But yeah, the story, like you said, you hear varying reports, but he got the part and they shot for anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks with Eric Stoltz. And what happened was Zemeckis and others were looking at the dailies, if you will, and the tone was off because Stoltz, he was playing it a bit more, I don't know if somber is the correct word, but he was just a bit more serious.
Serious, yeah.
Let's just put it plainly, he was just more serious. He didn't have quite the comic sensibilities that Michael J. Fox brings to the role. So he was a bit more serious, and so the tone was off and it wasn't testing well with the studio execs and the director, et cetera. They knew something was wrong. So there was some other stories too that.
Right. Cause like the rest of the cast was worried that they were all going to get recast too, because I did hear a story that Claudia Wells was not the original Jennifer right. Parker. And then they had to bring her in because whoever that was going to be realized to not work with Michael J. Fox as much as they did with Eric Stoltz. So now, you know, everyone's thinking like, well, also I'm going to lose a job.
There's a lot of, yeah, a couple different things here. One being that Eric Stoltz is around 6 feet tall and Michael J. Fox is about 5'5". So The actress that they had going to be playing against Eric Stoltz was a bit taller. She was going to be too tall for Michael J. Fox. They had to find someone height appropriate for Michael J. Fox, et cetera. So that was an issue. Also, there's stories about Stoltz and his style of acting. He was a method actor.
Yeah.
So he insisted on being called Marty, according to Tom Wilson, too, who played Biff. There's a scene in cafeteria where Marty has to shove Biff. And the story is allegedly that Eric Stoltz was pushing him, literally shoving Tom Wilson to the point where he's bruising him a bit. Wilson didn't take kindly to that, but it didn't come to blows or anything. But Stoltz is a serious actor, playing it very seriously. The problem was then now it's a budget thing too. I guess it costs anywhere from $3 to $4 million to scrap what they had and to do the reshoots. So varying reports, but
yeah, I think they say there is one shot that still has Stoltz in it.
I did see on YouTube, actually, there is the scene. We talked about the scene. It's right after they go into the diner and George is going to ask Lorraine to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance and he gets the chocolate milk. This is the scene where Marty stands up for George and punches Biff and then runs out. It's right before the big skateboarding scene. So you can see, if you watch it in slow motion, you see Michael J. Fox as he goes to swing at Biff, Tom Wilson, and then it's an over-the-shoulder shot looking at Biff, and that's Eric Stoltz actually throwing the punch. Mm-hmm. So it's a quick cut, but you can see there's a continuity problem too with the light, like the lighting's different, the blinds are in a different place behind Tom Wilson. So it's that moment you can actually see there's, and I heard some even in the, I think maybe even in that skateboarding scene too, that sometimes it's actually not Michael J. Fox, it's Eric Stoltz, but I'm not sure about that.
No, I don't know about that either.
But in that one, you can see when Michael J. Fox, punches Biff in the diner, there's a quick cut. It's over the shoulder of Eric Stoltz, not Michael J. Fox. So who knows what this movie would have been? It would have had a totally different tone. It wouldn't just be, it'd probably be a very different movie with Eric Stoltz. And Zemeckis is on record saying, he says it lately in an interview, and they all do, how much respect they have for Eric Stoltz as an actor. Totally qualified. Sometimes you're just not right for the part. And also The fact that it was one of the hardest decisions they had to make and one of the hardest conversations that Zemeckis has ever had, ever had to have with an actor to tell Stoltz, hey, we got to let you go, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of what happened. Mm-hmm. But Michael J. Fox and all his genius steps in, and he was the original choice. You can find all the details online.
Yes.
Hey, I was just going to say DeLorean, unfortunately, went bankrupt in 1982. They have a website now. They were bought by like a foreign company. Like it still exists and you can find DeLoreans to buy.
Yeah, I still see them every once in a while.
Do you have some other fun facts and trivia you'd like to bring up here, Bill?
Yeah, just like a couple of movies. There's so much stuff out there. And if we tried to go through that down that rabbit hole, we'd be here for another 2 hours. So I just try to pick out some fun stuff that I just found interesting to me. And it's just little dinky stuff like this. So when Lorraine follows Marty back to Doc's house and she and Doc have that exchange at the house, I didn't realize that's the only on-screen dialogue that Christopher Lloyd and Leah Thompson have in the trilogy. It's the only time they talk to each other.
It's crazy.
I mean, when you think about the movie, you know, Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Leah Thompson, and two of the actors only interact that small amount of time. I thought that was interesting.
That is very interesting. But yeah, that's a great fact. Back to the DeLorean thing real quick. I want to mention yet the writers Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis actually received a fan letter from John DeLorean after the film's release, thanking them for immortalizing his car.
Oh, and that they did.
I like this little story. This is a lot of stuff. You know, I just found on IMDb in 2010, during a cast reunion, Michael J. Fox said that strangers still call him McFly. The most remarkable instance when he was in remote jungle in South Asia, and a group of Buddhist monks passed him. And one of them looked at him and said, Marty McFly. Hilarious. How
random. I know. That's when you know you're big time.
Jeez. This script was rejected 44 times before it was finally greenlit.
It's crazy.
I hate that, but I love it at the same time. It gives me hope as a writer. I mean, the stuff you know what it is now. So we have the hindsight, you know, but you just think this kind of material is gold, you know, but 44 times.
Yeah, the fact they got nominated at the screenplay and 44 times someone said no, just ridiculous. Here's another fun fact, because we kind of mentioned this. There's a major height difference between Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox.
Right.
So they had to do some creative blocking in order to make them look like they are within the same height. Because I didn't realize this too, that Christopher Lloyd was that tall until reading this, because I just assumed, I knew Michael J. Fox was small.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, they got Christopher Lloyd at 6'1" and Michael J. Fox at 5'5". Yeah.
So what would happen? So what you would do is you actually put Michael J. Fox closer to the camera, and then you would have, you know, Christopher Lloyd kind of stand back. And then that's why I guess the Doc character has that awkward arch.
So Christopher Lloyd would hunch over.
Yeah.
That was so part of his performance. He would hunch over to shrink a little bit.
So it would make them look like they were a little more the same size. So that is cool. I just love those little camera tricks.
Yeah, playing with the depth of field there and basing them out to make them look closer in height, or just to fit them in the frame together.
Yeah, instead of having to just stand on an apple box all the time.
Yeah, right.
So you think I've got facts?
Yeah, I got a few other things. The head of Universal Pictures, Sid Sheinberg, did not like the title Back to the Future.
I love the story.
It's one of my favorite. He insisted that nobody would see a movie with future in the title. In a memo to Zemeckis, he said that the title should be changed to Spaceman from Pluto.
Running to the theater to see that one.
I repeat, the head of Universal wanted the title of this film to be Spaceman from Pluto.
It's so ridiculous. I can't believe that story's true.
I can believe it.
I mean, I can, but I can't.
And you know what I mean, though. Yeah, yeah. I agree. I totally agree with you. It's ridiculous. What's really funny is that once Zemeckis and his company had mentioned this to Steven Spielberg, they just, you know what they did? They just thanked Sid Sheinberg by sending a wonderful, it was like a note back to him saying, thanks for the wonderful joke memo that everyone got a kick out of it. And Sheinberg, who is too proud to admit he was actually serious with the title change, just gave in to letting the film retain its original title.
Thank God.
Which is just a great title. Back to the Future. Come on.
Yeah.
That's exactly what Marty has to do in the movie. He's got to
get it. I know. That's what made it so interesting. Back to the Future. What's that all about?
Yeah.
Spaceman from Pluto. I'm like, yeah, it sounds like a 50s B movie at best.
I talked about the Johnny B. Goode scene. Good old Michael J. Fox had to learn how to do his little air guitar, right? Which he was great. He was great. Nailed it. Musician Mark Campbell did all of Michael J. Fox's singing.
Oh, okay.
He is credited as Marty McFly. Mark Campbell was perhaps best known as the lead singer of popular 1980s band Jack Mack and the Heart Attack.
Oh, I've actually heard of them.
I have never heard of them, but that's cool. And it was cool that they found Mark Campbell because I thought his voice was close enough. Because people, when they sing, will alter their voice a little bit anyway, or their voice changes slightly. So I was like, oh, yeah, I can buy this guy's voice as Michael J. Fox's singing voice. I went with it. Yeah. Worked for me.
I wonder if he did the singing for Light of Day.
What's that?
Well, yeah, because that other movie that Michael J. Fox was in, Light of Day, with
John Jack.
Yeah. I'll have to look that up now.
Huh.
Not that I think.
That would be interesting. God, I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The University of Southern California, USC Film School, has writing classes, and they use the screenplay for Back to the Future as the model of the perfect screenplay.
Pretty good.
You got anything else, Bill Dan?
No, I knew we would be talking about everything else forever, so I tried to keep my facts and trivia light.
Here's one plot hole that I didn't bring up earlier, but this is a common question that the creators get, is that why did Marty's parents not remember Marty as the kid in high school who got them together? And the explanation is simply that, well, he was only in town for a week and wasn't with Lorraine and George every single day. It was like a blip on the radar. Granted, it was a big moment in their history, but seeing them seeing Marty 30 years later then, or, you know, having grown up with Marty, they just wouldn't necessarily put that together.
Yeah, that was originally going to be in my complaint department until I saw that quote. And I was like, all right, I'll give it to him. They're trying to explain it.
Yeah,
because like I said, they have no photo evidence of him.
Right.
So you can't go back and go, oh my crap, this guy looks exactly like our kid. So, all right, I believe it.
Because, yeah, the incident would happen. And then, granted, he wouldn't look like him until about 17 years later.
Right.
And then you'd be like, oh, our son looks strangely like that kid we knew for that week that kind of helped us get hooked up.
Yeah, I was always worried about the rug burning incident when he mentions that. I might give you away. Yeah, I let it go.
All right. I think that's all I got, man.
Let's move on.
Yeah, go for it.
Let's move on to box office. So this movie was released on July 3rd, 1985, on a budget of $19 million, three or four of which they had a scrap. It grossed $212.3 million domestically and $173.3 million internationally for a worldwide gross of $385.6 million.
Yeah.
Debuted at number one at the box office and was number one for 11 of the first 12 weeks it was playing in theaters. All right, listen to this one, Jason. The only movie to knock it out of the number one spot during that time was National Lampoon's European Vacation.
Wow. Really?
Yes.
That is, you know what? That is some serious bar trivia right there. That's a really good, well, that's just a great piece of movie.
All the summer movies. I'd
like to ask somebody, like, what is the one movie that European Vacation?
Yeah.
Crazy. Good. That's a great piece of trivia, a little stat there. Yeah.
Yep. So, and Back to the Future was the top grossing release of 1985.
Yeah, man.
So moving on to reviews. When growing up in the early 80s, we loved catching at the movies with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert to hear the reviews and watch clips from upcoming movies. The review of the film was, of course, unanimous. Two thumbs up. Gene found the film to have a real heart to it. The script was funny and interesting, and the real star of the film. Roger loved the concept of finding out what your parents were like when they were younger, because as a kid, you never think of your parents that way. So that takes us to additional thoughts and questions. Is there anything left we could talk about for Back to the Future?
Bill, I'm not going to let you off the hook that easy. Here's the thing. There's something I want you to work on.
Okay.
So when Marty gets into the DeLorean in the beginning and escapes and time travels to 1955, goes back to the past, runs out of juice, out of plutonium, he gets out of the car that's just now in the middle of the street, and he's still wearing his radiation suit. And someone in an old-timey car drives by. It's an old couple. It's an elderly couple.
Oh, yes.
I want you probably thinking of something else. I actually just want you to work on an impression for me. because he walks up to the car.
Oh, that lady freaks out.
And the lady goes, "Don't stop, Wilbur. Go."
I never understood why she freaked out like that.
Because it just made me think immediately again of, is that your blood? Like, you got to do, don't stop, Wilbur. Go. Just cracks me up.
I will work on it. She
freaks out.
I didn't understand. Like, you think back in that time, people were more friendly, and she's, God, you would have thought she had a flashback to like World War One or something. And I don't know. That was the other scene that I was kind of like, what was that all about?
Yeah. So near the end of the film, when Marty comes back to the future, to the present, really, and he's a little early, finds out Doc is alive. He wore a bulletproof vest. Well, then Doc says, you know what? He's going to fulfill his dream. He's going to climb into the DeLorean. He is going to go 30 years into the future. And then Marty again says, look me up. And he says, yeah, I'll be around 47,
mm-hmm.
which is funny, which is right around the age we are now, which is just kind of crazy. It's like,
yeah.
And here we are now, you know,
talking about it.
47. Like, he's like, yeah, 30 years in the future, I'll be 47. And here we are talking about it at each, well, a little bit slightly older. You get the idea. This made mm-hmm. me think. Is this the best use of a title of a movie in the movie itself? I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Doc actually says, next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
It's up there.
It's always fun when they actually say the title of the movie.
In the movie.
You know what's still up there for me, though, is Face Off. Actually take his face off. And they say it like 15 times. Oh, hey, I meant to look this up, man. What is the Florence Nightingale effect?
Oh, yeah. So Doc kind of explains it, where nurses kind of fall for injured soldiers.
Okay.
Let's do a little research.
Florence, I was just curious about that. I have to research that a little bit. Anybody out there knows what the Florence Nightingale effect is exactly, or why it was named that, or named after her? Anyway, hey, Bill Bant, do you have some additional? I'm taking up all the time here. Did you have some other additional thoughts?
No, you can hog away.
Wow, I'm going to hog away. Hey, man, I don't know if you recognize the fact that there are some coincidences between Back to the Future of 1985 and a short film that you and I were part of in 2012 called Desolate Road.
Go ahead.
One, I was like, did Bill name the lead character that I happened to play in Desolate Road Goldie after Goldie Wilson from Back to the Future? The other coincidence, I know that's not true. I don't think you came up with the name Goldie. So you're like, I'm just such a big Back to the Future fan, and I love Goldie Wilson.
No,
that's not true. The other coincidence is that the song Pledging My Love, sung by Johnny Ace, is playing in the car with Marty and Lorraine when they are, quote unquote, parking. And that is the song used in Desolate Road. That's the song. That's playing in the credits. Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
The end credits. Yep. Pledging My Love by Johnny Ace. So echoes of Desolate Road in Back to the Future, or echoes of Back to the Future in Desolate Road. It's funny to me how we just sometimes unconsciously steal from the best.
Yeah, I guess so. I just had music playing in the script. I didn't specify title.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't.
That was Marwan. I remember Marwan specifically wanted that song. Yeah, I was a big fan of that song. And that song has been used in a few other famous movies, but I picked up on it.
Good ears.
Yeah. Do you have any deep questions for me, Bill, regarding Back to the Future?
I can't believe I didn't come up with any questions for this one. I just knew we were going to be talking about this forever. So I was like, oh my God, we're going to go on and on with the questions. I mean, is this your favorite Michael J. Fox film? I guess that would be.
Wow. Yeah. Just off the top of my head, I have to say yes.
Yeah, I would think so too.
Doc Hollywood.
Cute.
That's a good one. Yeah, I know. I'm just throwing them out. Teen Wolf.
Which is film before Back to the Future, but came out after Back to the Future.
Yeah. I don't know. No, I mean, come on. Back to the Future is really, I mean, that's it.
85. That was the pinnacle of Michael J. Fox.
So great. I have a question for you. If there were ever to be like a spinoff / side story in the Back to the Future universe, I want to know what happens to Uncle Joey. There are a couple of funny references
in
this movie, because they're gathering around the dinner table in the beginning. They were going to celebrate Joey's parole, but he doesn't get out of jail.
Yep.
And then when he goes into the past, Uncle Joey's just a baby in a crib with the, and he's, and Marty makes that comment to better get used to those bars. I was like, oh, that would be kind of interesting to see what happens with Joey, because the future changes as a result of what Marty does in the past.
Yeah, because it's kind of sad, because you figure he probably went into prison in his early 20s, because if he's a baby and it's 30 years later and he's going for parole, so he's only getting out in his early 30s, so he probably had some...
I just think it would be completely random, like to take such a small, small, tiny, almost non-existent character in the Back to the Future world and build like a completely side story, but then has some strange, weird connection or thread.
Right. That would be that'd be kind of funny. Like, it would just be this whole story about this guy going to jail, and you're just like, why am I watching this? And then at the end you realize it's like, oh shit, that's
Joey Baines
from Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do a short story on that.
Because it made me think also when you were talking about seeing a more development of how Marty and Doc got to know one another, like that could be a whole thing, but we definitely don't need a prequel.
No.
Don't need to see it.
No.
Here's my only other deep question. Of course, what's your favorite 80s time travel movie? And I'll just throw in a few. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, The Terminator, Time Bandits, Somewhere in Time, The Final Countdown, or Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Oh, man.
I know you're partial.
Yeah, it's between Star Trek and The Terminator.
Yeah, man. I mean, Back to the Future has to be one, of course.
Right. I mean, that's a clear cut one. And then I'm really,
yeah, that is tough. Second. I may be partial to the Terminator, actually.
Yeah, my Terminator 2, Star Trek is 3.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
It's fun to think about looking up just time travel movies from the 1980s alone. It's plenty. That's all I got for questions, my friend.
All right. And technically, the next point is recommendations. Do we recommend this movie? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think we just did a 2.5 hour recommendation of this movie. So.
Yeah, it's one of the best that we just said. It's studied in film school. You want to learn how to, just the basics of storytelling. Watch Back to the Future. It's Robert Zemeckis doing his thing. And, we don't give him enough credit. This is probably thought by most, or not by most, but a lot, as a Steven Spielberg production, which it is, but his name is the first name you see when the credits come up. But this is directed by Zemeckis. He's wonderful. What a great cast. And you talk about great chemistry, and I love all the actors in this movie. But yeah, science fiction blended with comedy, blended with romance, blended with adventure. It's intense. It's a great feel-good movie, one for the family. Kids enjoy it. Everybody enjoys it. It holds up. Looks great. Go see it. Enjoy it from all aspects. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun to see it now because, back then when it came out, you were dealing with the present time period and then the 50s. Now you're looking at two different time periods in the past. You're looking at the 80s, and now you're looking at the,
great point.
The 50s again. So that's kind of cool. Going back and watching it that way, it is, in a way, you really don't have to change that much with it. I think for the most part, it does hold up really well. And yeah, it is in my top 10 80s films of all time.
No doubt.
So I think that might be the third one we've already done already. So I only got 7 left.
Yeah. And the sequels are fun too. There's aspects of each of the sequels that are great, but this is the one that everyone should see if you haven't seen it already millions of times.
Yeah, I know the third one gets a lot of
I actually love the third. I have a lot of fun with the third.
Yeah, I was so about it, but I'm like, I need to go back and watch that one now that I'm older and different perspective, and not your expectations are so high.
Mary Steenburgen?
Yeah, I did like the second one. I could see what people's complaints about that were, but I think it holds up. But yeah, I've definitely seen the first one 5 times as many as I've seen the other two put together. It's a classic. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. And if you haven't seen it in a while, go back and watch it again. It's still fun.
Yep. Awesome.
So I think that about wraps it up for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to our first episode of season two. Next week, we'll be discussing the action adventure movie Shoot to Kill, starring Sidney Poitier, Tom Berenger, and Christy Alley. As always, please subscribe, give us a review, and rate us. You can email us at all80smoviespodcast@gmail.com. Please send us your feedback, questions, or recipes to share. You can follow us on Facebook at All 80s Movies Podcast or tweet us at Podcast All 80s. Until then, have a totally great week, everyone.
Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, world.
My pine.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.